This class is entitled Shalom Bayit, and I'm going to get into that in just a second. I want to quickly just take a few minutes and introduce you to some new resources that First Truth Design is developing. Up on the screen, it's hard to see, but it's a new program we have which is called Hayesod. And Hayesod is something that we've been working on for the past 4 years. It's an extensive discipleship course intended to be an outreach to Christians and Christian communities to introduce them to their relationship to the land, the people, and the scriptures of Israel. It's very extensive. It's introductory, but at the same time, it's very in-depth. It has student workbooks. It has DVD teachings. The DVD teachings are done within the context of a Messianic Beit Midrash, a library, where myself and the other teachers are going and walking down the bookshelves and taking books off the shelves and affirming our teaching from Christian sources. It's done from the land of Israel. We have, each segment has 4 field trips to the land of Israel where we teach on location. It's very engaging. It's structured to help introduce Christians to their relationship to the land, the people, and the scriptures of Israel. This here is the startup pack for leaders. And in this package is a leadership guide, leadership training DVDs, promotional materials. We provide all kinds of promotional materials for you to use to mail out to friends or to hang up in libraries or whatever it may be. There's some very exciting things happening with the program. Our intention at First Fruits has always been and remains to be to see effective change within the greater body of Messiah, to see our brothers and sisters, our Christian friends, understand their relationship to the land, the people, and the scriptures of Israel, and begin to make changes, whatever that may be in their life, to that means. So there's a lot of exciting things happening. We have several very large churches that are participating in the program. We feel that once we get several key churches participating in the program, it'll kind of create a snowball effect for the program. We have a church in Houston that has 2,000 members that will be taking their church through the program. We have a church in outside the Chicago area that has 2,500 members that will be taking their members through the program. It's on. I started.
I'll just tell you. Are you going to, when Amber comes up?
Yeah.
So you could just pop this out and I think it's just record.
We'll just switch back and forth. So there's a lot of exciting things. So if this is the program doesn't fit your needs in terms of outreach, pray for us and pray for the effectiveness of the program in the lives of the people it's going to be touching. Our goal, our dream, is to take over the world for Messiah and Torah. And we feel that this program is a step in that direction. But we need group leaders to help us. We need people in homes, communities, churches, fellowship, reaching out with us with this program. In addition, another exciting project that we're working on at First Fruits is we've launched a new ministry called Vine of David. And Vine of David is a ministry for what we call a maturing Messianic Judaism. First Fruits Design is our outreach ministry. Vine of David is our ministry that's focused on a Messianic Judaism that is maturing and growing and needing resources to establish itself or reestablish itself as an expression of Judaism as we were within the first century. So we're developing a lot of various resources and commentaries, and one of the resources that we're working on is a comprehensive commentary set by a rabbi who came to faith by the name of Isaac Lichtenstein. And he wrote a extensive commentary on the New Testament, and we've been blessed to be a part of the publishing of that work. And our first volume on Matthew looks like it'll be out in the first quarter of 2010. And when that comes out, it will be a hardcover, just like you've seen in the art scroll books, like commentaries. It'll be hardbound, it'll be embossed, it'll be gold, and then God willing, over time, we'll just keep going Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and before too long, we will have a comprehensive commentary on the New Testament from a very authentic Jewish space or Jewish context. And it's a very exciting project. He was impassioned for the Messiah. All of you, you grew up knowing Yeshua for the most part. What you're excited about, what your passion is the Torah. Because that's something that's been lost in your life and something you're discovering. So your passion is there, and that's good. But the Jewish people, the Torah is second nature to them. They've lived in Jewish communities. They've embraced the Torah. They've lived within Torah context. So when a Jewish person comes to know the Messiah, they are equally as passionate for Yeshua as you are for the Torah. So Rabbi Lichtenstein became a passionate, devoted follower of Messiah, defending Yeshua on every level. And that was his, he felt that that's what he was created to do. He was brought in this world to write these materials from a Jewish space. So we're excited about that work, so you can be looking for that work that will help us understand our New Testaments from a Jewish perspective in the first quarter of 2010. The other day, I had the honor of addressing the General Assembly, and I spoke on integrity. The title of my teaching that day was Integrity Quotient, which actually is a title from a forthcoming book that we have at First Roots of Zion. This is a book that we've been working on for, gosh, it seems like 8 years now. The material that I'll be presenting to you today and also on Shabbat also comes from this book. This book is a book that we are moving up our priority. It's like moving up on our docket because we feel that our movement today, more than any time in the past, needs men of integrity to lead and to guide and to help move us to a higher place of maturity. So we can talk about the need to have a mature messianic movement with mature leaders, godly leaders. But leadership starts in the home. If your home is out of order, how can we expect to have a movement that's in order? If your home is out of order, usually it's an indication that your marriage is out of order. So the first place to start when saying we need a more mature, balanced, measured, gracious, kind, loving, balanced, messianic movement, to work towards that in the future, we need to start where that begins, and that's with the marriage of a man and a woman. That's where it begins. So today, I'd like to talk to you about some principles of Shalom Bayit. Shalom Bayit is a term that is used very frequently within Greater Judaism. It essentially means peace at home. It's the concept of domestic harmony and good relations between a husband and wife. I think there's a television show that still runs by a rabbi by the name of Bateach is his last name. Shmuley Bateach. He's a Chabad rabbi, and it's called Shalom in the Home. And he takes his little trailer, his little RV, and he'll go into crisis situations, and he'll help try to mend the marriage. Has anyone seen this Shalom in the Home? Okay. Shalom in the Home is Shalom Bayit. It's trying to fix marriages. In Jewish court of law, Shalom Bayit is the Hebrew term or the idea of reconciling a marriage, bringing a husband and wife back together. One of the teachings that I'll be presenting this week is entitled Selfless Love, where I'll develop 15 parallels for marriage demonstrated by the Messiah demonstrated by the Messiah's love for his bride. It's based upon this text in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, that encourages husbands to love your wives as Messiah loved the church and gave himself up for her. And what we do in this teaching is we look at 15 traits or characteristics of how the Messiah loved his bride, sacrificed, he was faithful, endearing, kind, patient. And we look at his traits in those regards, and then we say to us as men, act like Messiah. Be like Messiah. Live like Messiah. In fact, and I'll develop this further on Shabbat, as men, we need to be the very picture of Messiah to our wives. We are an example of Messiah to our wives. That's our responsibility. They need to not be nurtured, nurtured, or to look to other men as examples of godly men. They need to first and foremost see that represented in our lives. So we'll be looking at that on Shabbat. So today we're going to be considering Shalom Bayit. This is a picture which you can't see at all, but it's a beautiful picture of a husband and a bride standing under. Can you turn that off for a second? Does that help? There you go. Of standing under a tallit in union, coming together. There's some fundamental differences in Jewish marriage and Jewish approach to marriage than exists within Western societies. Jewish marriage is first and foremost based upon the necessity to raise Jewish children, to raise another generation, to raise godly, to have a godly home, a Torah-centered home, for the sake of the covenant, for the sake of God. Not for the sake of having a nice family with 2.2 kids and living on a cul-de-sac and the American dream. It's more of a responsibility for the sake of the establishment of the kingdom, for tikkun olam, to prepare this world, having godly children that can affect change in a hurting place. Because there's a fundamental different approach to marriage in regards to responsibility versus just a dream, you see oftentimes that attraction is a component of Jewish marriage, but not the fundamental part of Jewish marriage. We all know that love takes time to develop. When you're in love with someone, maybe we can consider that being infatuated with someone, because love is developed through hard work and commitment. So Jewish marriage begins with the premise of you have a responsibility as a man and woman, you're coming together, and your responsibility is to build a union that will build a strong family, that will support a strong community. So I thought we would work through some concepts today of Shalom Bayit together. Shalom Bayit, when I hear this, there's three concepts that I think of: completeness, wholeness, and fulfillment. Hence the tradition in Jewish marriage is characterized by peace, nurturing, respect. Chesed means kindness, through which a married couple becomes complete and becomes part of the generations of God's called out ones that are continuing to build Torah faithful homes. So my wife is going to come up here in just a second, and she's going to help work through these five concepts with me. Boundaries in a marriage, communication in a marriage, loyalty in a marriage, spiritual headship, and issues of modesty. So, like I said the other day, in regards to issues of integrity, I'm not coming before you as the idealistic or the ideal husband. I have shortcomings as a husband. Our marriage is a good marriage, but it's not like the picture perfect marriage. We've had to work over the years as a husband and wife in developing a love for one another and maintaining a love for one another. So although we get the honor of talking to you about this, we're not talking down to you, we're talking with you. We are faced with every other issue that every one of your marriages face. this topic came as a result of just conversations that Mr. Kelly, Tim, and I had regarding the need to not only discuss issues of theology at events like this, but also come away with some practical things that can help us as people become better people, have better marriages, be better men, raise better children. So while this is a lecture, my wife and I are going to be more discussing this with you. We'll have some time for some questions. If we do take questions, please, as Tim said this morning, keep it concise and on topic, because I want to be able to answer as many questions as possible, and I want to be able to work through them with you. So let's keep them together. So, honey, you want to come up? This is my wife, Amber. We've been married for... We've been married for 20 years. We met when we were in 7th grade. The day she saw me, she knew that I was going to be her husband. It took me a little longer to figure that out. We started dating in 9th grade, 10th grade, and we got married the summer out of high school after our senior year. And we started our family right away. And we married young, and we've spent essentially our lives together, and it's been a tremendous blessing. Hashem has blessed us greatly, and I'm grateful that He has provided me that opportunity. We've taken the things that we've learned as a married couple, and we've done our best to impart that into our children. From a very young age, we realized that we were raising a Torah family, and that if our lives were going to be effective in terms of the kingdom, that we had to have a generational point of view. So we raised our children from the day that they were born under the umbrella of Torah, under the umbrella of boundaries and communication and modesty and all these issues, in order to guard them and shape them. So with me today is my eldest daughter, Shayna, and my other two kids are running around. My oldest son, Jeremiah, is 19. He is a wonderful young man. He is focused on the things of God. He has a heart for God. He has a passion for the things of the Word. That's what his life revolves around. He doesn't care about driver's license. He doesn't care about dating. He doesn't care about any one of these things. His primary focus, sometimes to his detriment, is just thinking about the things of the kingdom. So that's a little bit about our life. I guess to some that may sound, again, idealistic or ideal, but believe me, it's tough. It's, you know, we all have to shape our lives and struggle through those. So we are going to begin by talking about boundaries. Oops. And the first thing that we're going to talk about, I'll just put this all down, what we're going to be talking about regarding boundaries, is family structure, parenting and discipline, time and planning, hospitality and giving, strengths and weaknesses. We have a lot of material to go through, but it's just going to be just, you know, quick stuff. Each one of these slides could be an entire seminar in and of themselves. There's some resources that we can recommend. One resource that I would recommend that's very popular, you probably already have it, in regards to boundaries, is entitled Boundaries. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble. You can buy it at anything. It's just a book that talks about the need to have boundaries in your life. And that's an excellent, excellent principle to have that will guard every component of your life. So boundaries are an important component of how we function as families and as married couples. So I'm not sure how we're going to kind of tag team this through. Would you like to just start with family structure?
Sure.
Okay.
We have found that one of the most important things in raising children and having a happy marriage is to be in agreement with the way that you're going, to have some kind of a set direction, to have set goals, to have a common vision of where you want to go and how you're going to get there. There is nothing worse than just being in a marriage and suddenly you feel like, well, gosh, why is my husband doing all that over here to promote this or that, and I'm here and I'm trying to get this going. If you haven't done so already, and I feel so a little bit not really qualified because I see a lot of gray-headed people in the audience, and I know I'm young, but I know that for us, one thing that's really worked is to just to get to a point where we say, okay, for this next year, let's try to accomplish 1, 2, and 3. Or for this next year, let's not do blah, 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 whatever from the last year. So if you have never done this in your marriage, I just would encourage you to, because it's very beneficial to know where you're going, how you're going to get there, to know that you're in agreement in going there, and then that gives you a common goal to pursue.
So family structure in our home is very simple. I'm the head of our home. My wife is my partner. We are one flesh. We function together as a team. While I'm the head of our home, I submit to her as much as she submits to me. But we work together. In regards to parenting and discipleship, this structure is important of having a head, having a leader in your home, and submitting to one another. That's a critical component of establishing boundaries and establishing a environment, a foundation that you can build your family upon. Discipline was an interesting issue for us early on. We were disciplined different as children, so we brought our discipline styles into our home. We quickly realized it wasn't working. One of the things that we did early on is we developed a system, and we actually read this somewhere, so it's not our idea, but it worked for us. But we basically developed a system which guarded or put boundaries on our disciplining of our children. So when they violated some family rule or something, they knew what to expect in regards to their discipline. And that actually guarded my anger or frustration as a father if they did something that was bad, rather than me reacting and going beyond the boundaries in disciplining. I had a rule that governed my actions. Our rule was we did spank our children, and it was one swat per infraction. So if our child misbehaved, it would be just one swat. We would do it in a private place. We would do it we would take our children and say, let's go to our bedroom. It wasn't out of anger. It wasn't at the moment. It was always it was almost like a holy act, so to speak, of like communicating and talking and praying and disciplining and all these type of things. And that came to work well, probably more for me and us as parents to even know our boundaries as with our children.
Another thing that was very helpful and effective with having a discipline structure is that it cut down on the amount of times that the children would say, well, that's not fair. You just let Jeremiah do, you know, some certain thing, and now I'm getting a spanking, and I'm doing the same thing that he did. And especially for our family, we had 4 children in the span of 5 years. So we had really little kids all together, and then elementary age kids all together, and then teenagers all together. And it was nice for me as being a stay-at-home mom to have that guideline and that consistency, because it cut down on it, or it helped my ability to be fair and to, I guess, just execute judgment in like a fair and in a way that the kids could expect and they knew what was coming.
We taught our children first-time obedience, and I can tell you that it is possible. It takes consistency on your part as parents, but you can train your children to respond to you on first-time obedience without talking back, without pausing. First-time obedience is possible. It's not impossible. Oftentimes, people have always asked us about different styles of discipline. I don't think that there is a set style of discipline. We paddled our kids, spanked our kids. We also did other things. But I think you can use different forms of discipline as long as you're consistent in what you do. As long as they know what's going to happen and you're consistent in that. It can be time out. It could be whatever. It could be grounding. Whatever works best. The key to parenting in regards to discipline is consistency, in my opinion. I want to quickly go through the rest of this. Hospitality and giving. We've had a life of a lot of families and a lot of people involved in our lives, and we felt so idealistic early on in the Torah movement about just these Torah discussions we would have and people coming into our home and all these type of things. And it just began to wear when we didn't have boundaries in terms of people coming into our home and guarding our home and setting time limits and those type of things. So, and that wore on our relationship as well. So I think it's important to have boundaries in regards to hospitality, giving of yourself, giving of your time, because it takes away from your marriage. We lost probably 5 years of our marriage giving to other people because we didn't have boundaries in place. So don't lose time in your marriage by not having boundaries that all of a sudden things get out of control. I regret those years because I realized every conversation that we had for 5 years revolved around our congregation and people in our congregation and situations in our congregation. That was what our marriage was about. It wasn't even about our family anymore. It was about our congregation. So guard your marriages from being taken advantage of, and don't lose time with your precious partner that the Father's given you. Strengths and weaknesses. Do you want to address that quickly?
Yeah. There's an understanding in Judaism that every person is kind of like half a person searching for their soulmate, and that without the other half of you, you're limited in your ability to do what Hashem has called you to do on the earth. So as married couples, we do have to function together. It's like puzzle pieces, because a lot of Boaz's strengths are my weaknesses, and some of my strengths are his weaknesses. And I know that it really was helpful for us to just look at one another and to be able to honestly say, okay, you're not very good with being somewhere on time, but that's something that I'm picky about. So I'm gonna run the countdown. I'm gonna have the kids dressed, and I'm gonna have them fed by a certain time, and I'm gonna say, in order to get to this destination, we need to leave 25 minutes early from the house. And how can I participate in helping us to be on time? And then there's other areas that I need help. But it's good to just be honest with one another and to realize that as a married couple, we don't all have to be the end-all, be-all on everything, but that we're working together as a team. And so the areas that I'm weak, I allow Boaz to be strong. I lean on him to be strong because I see that that's an area of weakness to me.
So moving on to communication, here are the 3 points that we'll just briefly cover. Men and women dynamics, honesty, constructive and destructive forms of relating with one another. So why don't you start with dynamics between men?
Okay, well, I think most of us know that men and women process things differently. Women like to usually talk things to death, and men usually want the bottom line. So as far as communication goes, I think it's good when we can help one another to grow in those areas. So if we're having a time of strain or something that we need to talk about, I try to remind myself, okay, Boaz is going to want this in 3 points and a bottom line. And then usually once we get through that initial, you know, like, I'm upset because blah, I feel bad because this, I'm irritated at this, and I want your help. Or, you know, how can we work through this? Usually it's a lot more productive when we kind of outline how we're going to talk about something, and then we kind of get into more of, like, discussing things and talking back and forth. But it's not always that way. Communication is such a give and take. sometimes I really, really want to talk about something and it's just not the time. And that's okay. It doesn't have to be the time every time. But just to know and realize the differences that men and women have and to be okay with that and to know, you know, when to implore which kind of communication.
So the second point and the third point, all this kind of goes hand in hand, but honesty, if you can't be honest with your spouse, who can you be honest with? So it's important that you express your frustrations, your hurts, your needs, all of those things. And if the spouse is unable to hear them, and you're not able to communicate, there's nothing wrong with bringing in a qualified person to help you communicate with one another through times of difficulties or crises. The important thing is, don't stop communicating. You must maintain communication. When I get upset at times in our marriage, she knows immediately because I shut down in terms of communication. I don't talk. I just kind of process things, and I could go like 2 or 3 days without talking. And then at some point she'll tell me to grow up and stop acting like a baby, and let's work it through. So she's being honest, and I'm, I guess, throwing a fit. Maybe I should work on that. It doesn't happen that often. It only happens once every 10 years or something. So just be honest with each other. Figure out ways to communicate. If you're not getting through, I think it's 50% your fault. You have to learn how to communicate. It's not always the other person's fault. So learn how to communicate. Constructive and destructive ways of communication, this is individual, but just be aware that there are ways in which you can break communication, or communication can stop because of little things that are said. Little digs, little references, past hurts, whatever it may be, aren't constructive to moving forward in a positive way of communication. Loyalty. This is true for the marriage, it's true for your parenting, it's true for, at least for us, as past congregational leaders and people in ministry, we lean on each other greatly, and at times we feel like no one likes us, no one loves us, no one cares for us, and we have to always have a sense that someone does love me and care for me. So being loyal is essential. It's important you're on the same team. We are part of a movement that maybe a lot of you struggle with, like your spouse is not being on the same page in regards to Torah or your interests or your cares. Depending on who, you know, how that marriage relationship is, we oftentimes will have ladies writing us and say, well, my husband doesn't want to honor the Shabbat. What should I do? Because I want to honor the Shabbat. Our answer is always, always, always do what your husband says to do. You may not like it, but in some way, honor the Torah and honor your husband, but default to your husband. This is the principle that we feel that Paul presents. That may go against like our like fundamental like sense of truth and what's correct, but at the same time, it seems to be the order in which the scriptures establish, and it seems to be something in which God gives much grace to people in those situations. So be on the same page. Amber did a lecture the other day on optimism. I don't know how many of you ladies were in that, but believing the best in one another and trusting one another to be concerned for the good of one another, and believe the best of one another, be optimistic, be hopeful, be encouraging, all of these things help strengthen the marriage relationship. And in solidarity, be on the same page, be connected with one another, be in be strengthened by one another.
Yeah, I think one thing that comes to my mind with this is in parenting, especially, I don't know that children mean to do this, but it happens a lot where dad might say that we're going to do something a certain way and the kids don't like it. And so they go say, well, Mom, can we go to the picnic this weekend? And then I say, well, sure, that sounds like a lot of fun. And I don't know that my husband has said, we have other plans. We're not going to go to the picnic this weekend. I think it's crucially important for the parents to always be in solidarity with one another. So now that we've been parents for 20 years, when the kids come and say to me, well, can we go and do the high ropes activity? I say, well, what's Dad say? That's always my first response. What did Daddy say? Or let's go check with Dad. Because I have found that there's not very much that breaks down the marriage relationship with the children faster than the parents being in strife about something in regards to how to raise the kids. And as your kids get older, that doesn't change. Even adult children want to hear from Dad, want to hear from Mom, and they seek out opinions that they're looking for. So, and every one of us does this. It's just part of how we are. This is kind of an area for me that would be my confessional. And I think there's a concept in Judaism that talks about how a helpmate is in some ways, the Hebrew word is against you. And it doesn't mean that we are striving against one another. It means that we are balancing one another. And so sometimes I might hear of something that Boaz said or have some kind of a situation. I say, you know what? No. I know how my husband is. I know that he would react in this certain way. And it's very important to have that level of trust, especially in a greater community setting, because people tend to say things about other people, or people tend to make judgments about how your husband's acting, or what he's saying, or what you're saying, or what you're not saying. And so it's critically important that we believe the best in who our spouse is, and that we always trust that.
So let's move on and talk about spiritual headship. I'm going to be talking primarily about this on Shabbat, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. I put this number one up, Lord of the House, because I like it. In Hebrew, it's Balabait. It's the head of the home, the Lord of the House. So it would be proper, biblically, for my wife to refer to me as the Lord. Anyway, that doesn't happen very often, but I try. And then, as I said, we're going to be looking at 15 points of Yeshua's example of how he nurtured the bride, the congregation, the Kehilah, and we're going to be looking at that in regards to our responsibilities as husbands to nurture our wives and to care for them and to love them. The last area that we want to discuss is the area of modesty. I was stunned one time in regards to just kind of like, I sat back and thought, really? That people really think that way? That really happens? For years, you know, we've known each other since seventh grade. We love each other and a great deal. And we would hold hands in front of people. We would hug in front of people. People from our congregation would come over to our house and, you know, we'd sit on the couch and I'd have my arm around her or whatever it may be. And we did not think anything of it. We didn't think that was a bad thing. In fact, we would have thought that was a good thing to demonstrate to others the strength of our marriage, the strength of our love, our commitment to one another. But I realized over a series of events that our outward demonstration of our love for one another, physically, touching each other in front of one another, hugging in front of people, those type of things, actually hurt other people and drove deep, deep, like, seeds of bitterness into people's hearts. And then we started learning Judaism's approach to modesty. And Judaism taught the value of guarding your love from public exposure. Like not hugging in front of people and not like doing things that are meant to be done privately, intimately, whether it's a kiss or holding hands or whatever it may be, around other people. Now, that may strike some of you as strange, but from our experience, we've experienced the value in this time and time and time again. We had one young couple that just, it was like they're watching our marriage, watching our union, watching our relationship, and it was literally driving them apart because he didn't treat her in a loving way, or he didn't put his arm around her, or he didn't speak to her in this way, or she didn't respond to him in this way. And as a result of that, what we were actually doing, something that we thought was good, was driving a wedge in that marriage because they weren't being treated that way, and they wanted to be loved that way, or touched that way, or considered that way. So when I have this first point about guarding your love, I think this is something that we need to consider. I think there's value there. I think preserving things of intimacy guard and make them more intimate. Whether it's a lovey-dovey name that you have for your wife that you only speak privately rather than publicly. Whether it's putting your arm around her or giving her a hug or those type of things in public view. I think it's important that we guard it. In Judaism, I put up there a picture of this picture here. And throughout the ceremony, the husband and wife don't touch each other. They don't engage. In fact, in our tradition, it's often said, "Kiss the bride," and it's kind of that awkward moment, especially if they start making out, where everybody's sitting there like this is kind of strange and difficult. In Judaism, no public display of affection takes place. In fact, what happens is immediately after the union is established publicly, the bride and the groom go privately to a room and spend as much time as they want in a private room, and this private room is usually made up with different types of, like maybe candies or chocolate, whatever it may be, to allow them to sit and enjoy the moment together and have their first kiss be something private and preserved. So, modesty is something in which we can learn a lot that actually, if you understand modesty from a Jewish perspective, it actually shapes every component of your life. It guards your speech. It guards your behavior. It guards your actions. This is a big, big, big issue. Modesty, in our minds, oftentimes we just think about clothing and how low the neckline is or how tight the pants are. That's really not modesty from a Jewish perspective. That's a component of it, but it's far broader and far bigger than that. So it's guarding your love for one another and protecting that and preserving that. It's guarding your tongue and not saying sexual innuendos in front of others about relations or, you know, like off-colored things that seem innocent and aren't explicit but do paint pictures in people's minds. Like just a statement like, "Yeah, I had a late night last night," or something like that, that would be indicating that my wife and I had relations last night. That's completely improper from a Jewish perspective. And it paints pictures in people's minds that are inappropriate, that they should never be thinking.
There's also something that we women have a tendency to do when we have had a fight with our husband, or when we're in a particular situation where there's tension, and we might get on the phone with a girlfriend and, "Oh, well, you know, last night we just had it all out about this or that, and, you know, he totally doesn't see my point," and, you know, going on and on. It doesn't necessarily have to be sexually related. It can still be an intimate detail of your marriage that you don't need to be sharing with other people.
And also this issue of modesty and guarding your love and protecting and preserving actually from a very young age begins to guard your children and shape their minds of how men and women relate to one another in a sexual way, in an intimate way. That they're not always seeing people hold hands, make out. They see that it's something special and beautiful and preserved and private. So from a very young age, the children begin to get a different picture of what relationship looks like between a man and woman as opposed to what the world would be giving them. I think we're out of time in regards to the session, but I'd like to take some time to answer any questions that you might have. I just want to say something. Amber said that there's a lot of elders in this room. We live in a very broken and hurt world, and we live in a world where which is like marriages and covenant mean nothing. And we all know the statistics of like the 50% thing, and the 50% is the same thing in the world as it is in the church. And if that statistic is true, that would mean that some of you in this room have been affected by divorce and hardship and hurt and pain. So I want to acknowledge that. And I realize, you know, by us telling our story or us talking about this, as an elderly person, you could be reflecting at this point saying, I could have done things better, or I'm hurting right now. I'm feeling that hurt once again of loneliness or disappointment or whatever. And I just want to acknowledge that to say, number one, I'm sorry that you're feeling that way. And number two, that it's never too late to make a difference. You know, your marriage or your situation may be difficult, but you can invest in your grandchildren. You can invest in your children. You can tell them stories and tell them ways that you wish that you would have done things differently. You can express your hurt and your pain to your children, letting them and warning them to not go down that same path. You can be honest and transparent with those in your life to warn them about the difficulties and the loneliness or the frustration that you now feel in life as a result of choices that you made. This is the way that Judaism views generations. It's never too late to repent. It's never too late to make a difference. It's never too late to do what's right. So all of us have the opportunity to affect people, whether our own children or people in our community or children in our areas of influence. So we can become better people, make a better world, make a better body of Messiah. Any questions? Yes?
Seeing that there is a number of elders in this room, and more often don't have children, there are days that we can still spend.
Right.
is there any book or anything that you would recommend to grandparents, or do they could recommend to their children that might help them?
There's several that have affected our lives greatly. You might know the names of them better. One of the things that we got that actually became, there's two books. One's called the Big Spiral Bound, the one for the girls.
Training in Righteousness.
Training in Righteousness.
Mm-hmm. There's several resources put out by a company called Doorpost, one word. Training in Righteousness is just an overall guidebook that outlines different sins from the scriptures. And then they have a special book for girls and a special book for boys on developing character. But that was one main resource that we used in correcting our children if the issue at hand was lying. I would take down the Training in Righteousness book, look up lying. It's all listed by topic. And I would say, you know what, let's read what the Bible says about lying. You know, falsehood and the man who has, you know, the truth is not in his tongue and, you know, on and on and on. And then part of our discipline process as our children came to the age where they were too old to be saying is that they had to copy the scriptures from the book that talked about this specific violation. And then there was always some kind of a grounding or...
One of the things that helped us the most is that the same company that produces that chart?
Yes.
So they produced this chart. It's a, you know, big poster. And on it has, like, lying, talking back,
cheating, fighting, hitting
your sister, or whatever it may be. All these the things that kids always do. And then there's parts where you write the discipline that they receive for those actions. So again, this is part of that boundaries. You let your children know this is the consequence for this action. You do this behavior, this is what can be expected. So it takes the whole guesswork, the whole argument, hey, that's not fair, whatever. It's like, it's fair because it's posted and stated. So one of the things we did was like, okay, you hit your brother, go look at the chart and tell me what your discipline is. They'd go to the chart, come back, I can't play with my toys for a day, or something like that. So that chart became very helpful for us to structure the way that we disciplined our children. Another thing that we did, there was a teacher, he's no longer around, and I don't even know where he did his tape series, but we received a tape series where the teacher taught this idea of what he called boot camp. And it was this intense period of like 2 weeks in which like, okay, my kids are out of control. They talk back, they're no longer doing first response obedience, they're fighting, whatever it may be. So this guy taught this principle of boot camp where you acknowledge to your children, say, okay, for the next 2 weeks, boot camp. Here's what it looks like. If you talk back, if you fight, if you do this, we're kind of ramping it up a notch because we're going to get back to, like, first response obedience. We're going to get our home back in order. We had to do this all the time because we would travel. We'd get out of our structure. We'd get out of our home. And we'd get back and our kids would be out of control. They'd go spend a week with their grandparents and be like, okay, it's time to get, boot camp.
No offense to the grandparents. But one thing, one big thing in that whole boot camp scenario was sitting down with the children and taking responsibility to say, look, Dad and I have let up, and we should not have done that. We have not been careful to follow through with your training. We have not been as diligent with your training as we've needed to be over the last 2 weeks, and we take responsibility for that. We recognize that as our flaw, and we're sorry. And we would say to the children, would you please forgive us? Yes, they would forgive us. Okay, now guess what? I'm back to normal.
So, good. Let's see. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Do you model a healthy affection in front of your children? Because they won't be able to turn around.
Yeah, occasionally. Yeah, we tell each other, we affirm each other emotionally all the time. We speak words of love. We laugh together. We have, we show that we love each other. And we do, like if we go on a family walk, I'll hold hands with my daughter as much as I hold hands with my wife. So it's our affection is demonstrated throughout the family. So we do that, but it's not to the expense of my children or vice versa. Yes. I don't recall.
Yes, that's right. Townsend. Yes, that's right. Yes, they co-authored it.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Tim.
Talk about showing affection in your home and in your life. What do y'all feel about the tradition of the great community of hugging each other?
Well, we're not huggers. So it's funny because we had a congregation, and our congregation was several hundred people. And half the people loved to hug, and the other half didn't want to be hugged. So we always had this really funny time where I'd say, okay, it's time to meet and greet everybody, say hello. For those of you that, don't hug, just stay seated over here. For those of you that hug, go hug over here. And it would be like, you'd see people just sitting there and other people just hugging. It was like, I think we need to acknowledge that in our fellowships, and I think we need to give space for people that want to hug, and I think we need to make sure that we preserve the privacy of people that don't want to be hugged. So maybe make a lighthearted thing like I did out of it to kind of calm an awkward situation. For us in our congregation, it turned into this kind of just real lighthearted fun time of like, you know, the huggers making fun of the nun. It was kind of a fun situation. So that's what we did. But I think it's important. I mean, I think we live in a society that we can't close our eyes to the statistics of the world that we live in, and those things all, you know, they affect people. They ignite sparks. People take advantage, and so we should guard those things. Last question. Any other thing? All right. Oh, yes. Okay. Well, I'll take two more.
All
right. Okay. Yeah, that would. I have a feeling the non-huggers present—they're like an intense group of people. Oh, you're a hugger? Oh, wow! You don't look like a hugger. Yes, sir. With us, we have just always communicated to our children. We talk to our kids. If you just talk, be best friends with one another, talk, relate with one another, be honest with one another. I think a family that talks and connects is a family that can make it through all those different scenarios you talked about. Well, I don't know if those families talk or not, and I just think it's important that people communicate. Talk to your daughter, talk to your son, you know, be best friends with them, go on walks with them, hold their hands, you know, relate with them. I think it's important that there's a line of communication and there's honesty in that communication. Yes? Praying together. That's true. He just said praying together, and I agree. Praying together is very valuable component of marriage relationship. Look. Yeah. I would just encourage you all to study the laws of modesty from a Jewish perspective, and then you can determine the answer there. I think it's a valuable area of study. I think that we have been, as a Western society, we have lost all concepts of what it means to live modest lives. So I would just encourage you. Last question.
Going back to his comment about the children, you talk about how to handle a child, your children, who are exposed to that kind of situation. We have a very small fellowship. I mean, it's, small and you want to develop, you know, you teenage, almost cusp, on the cusp, you know, we find that the children from public schools are much more lovely.
Yeah, that's part of boundaries.
I mean, what do you, how do you work in them to change, help change?
In our fellowship we had very clear guidelines in that area where we said it is not proper to talk about boy-girl relationship, period. So we don't ever want to hear anybody say, I think this person's cute, I like this person. That type of talk was off the table, and it was part of like the policy of what we would talk about as a community, that this is not the type of stuff that we talk about.
And another thing too that we did in our congregation that was helpful is that once the kids became bar bat mitzvah, like 12 or 13 years old, they were expected to behave as an adult, to be with the adults, to be always in conversation with the adults, to be in the fellowship hall with the adults, and really any time that we saw that age group of kids going outside or pairing off or going into a room where there was nobody, we just had an agreement with the other adults in our fellowship that we would keep the kids together.
The age. The age. Bar mitzvah is based upon this is an area of modesty. This is to show you how it works. Bar mitzvah bat mitzvah are based upon the ability of the child to create, procreate. And the idea is, if that's the case, then some kids that are 12 or 13 aren't mature, they can't procreate yet. So what Judaism said, that's kind of embarrassing to say, are you able to procreate yet? Have you gone through puberty? So they said that in order to preserve modesty and to preserve people's privacy, they just set the age at 13 and 12 because that's typically the time in which that begins to happen so that children are preserved. So basically it says at 12 or 13, you're an adult. You're gonna act like one, because if you can procreate, if you can create life, you're gonna be an adult and you're gonna act like an adult. Mm-hmm. Last question. I said this before, but this is I mean it after this one. There are several, and we can recommend them to you. If you'd like to talk to my wife or my daughter, both of them are well aware of multiple books that you could drive and learn about modesty. So thank you all for your time. I hope this was helpful.
It's me again. Her father gave me written permission